Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here. We have a couple of bills that have a number of people who want to testify. I believe we'll have plenty of time. I apologize that all of our committee's not here at this point. We do have a quorum, though. This is our first day to be starting at the 8 o'clock slot, so maybe some people need to reset their alarms. With that said, we're going to start off with Senate Bill 369. I'll open up a hearing on that. And what I'm going to do is, China, why don't you give us the overview? And while you're doing that, our first four speakers are going to be Lane Shutterly, Victoria Blashley, Jeff Chine, I guess, and Ben Orzefi, I believe. Lane is, I don't know if is Senator Knop with you? Are you?
No, he is not with me.
Yeah, he's on the other side. If you'll bring your chair up so we can have the four of you together, and Shauna, why don't you give us the overview?
Certainly, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 369 is the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. It was developed by the Uniform Law Commission and has been introduced in 22 states, including Oregon. To date, Delaware is the only state that has adopted the act. The measure gives fiduciaries access to and control over digital assets of a deceased user or a protected person. You have the proposed -1 amendments, which define the content of electronic communication as communication that was sent or received by an account holder, held in electronic storage by a custodian, and is not readily available to the public, makes several other clarifying language changes, and revises the provisions on terms of service agreements. We have paperwork ready on the -1 amendments.
All right, so what we're going to do is we have another panel of opponents that are going to be for a number. So I'm going to kind of monitor time about 35, 40 minutes for the total. So break that out up close to 20 or so thereabouts, and we'll kind of be able to have some fudge factor. So who are Lane, are you going to start us off?
I will. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here this morning. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Lane Shutterly. Here this morning in my capacity as a commissioner from Oregon on the Uniform Law Commission. The bill this morning, Mr. Chair, it's a housekeeping bill. I guess not. House Bill or Senate Bill 369 would enact the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, which is a product of the Uniform Law Commission. I just want to give you a very brief introduction as to the process by which the bill came about. The thesis of the bill is that while our laws governing the management of property by fiduciaries for individuals, that is, in this case, specifically personal representatives of decedent's estates, conservators of incapacitated and protected persons, trustees of trusts, and agents under powers of attorney. While the law governing their authority to administer property for the benefit of their principals is focused on what we would consider to be traditional assets, the property, the physical property, physical assets, safe deposit boxes, money in the bank accounts, documents in the file folders. In fact, as Senator Thatcher sort of led with her question to me last week on the Probate Modernization Act, property is advancing and technology is changing the nature of property from the what we consider to be the traditional assets to digital. More and more what we own is being maintained online. What we keep of ourselves, perhaps in used to be journals, we keep now through social media. More and more of what we have and what we know of and keep of ourselves is being kept in that digital world. But the property, the law by which we deal with the management of those assets in the event of incapacity or in the event of death, is still rooted in the very traditional laws, and we are having more and more a disconnect with how we deal with the management of those assets. Recognizing that, the Uniform Law Commission established a project a couple of years ago to deal with the modernization of the law to make it more feasible for fiduciaries to manage those digital assets for estates and for their agents. The commission put together a work group broadly representative of commissioners from around the country and involving a great number of observers, including members of the Trust and Estates Bar around the country, and also representatives of the internet service provider industry, the business side of the internet, and met over 2 years with the work group developing the bill, incorporating suggestions and recommendations from both sides, both the Trust and Estate side as well as industry side, and what you have is the bill before you today. I'll be very brief about it, just winding up here, and then turn it over to my colleagues. Again, the important thing about this is that it recognizes that while the requirements of fiduciaries to manage property for decedent's estates and for protected persons and for trusts, the requirements of that have changed because of the nature of the evolution in the way we hold property, the law hasn't, and the law needs to evolve so that we have access by those fiduciaries to those assets that exist in the cloud. And on the internet. And that's what this bill does. It deals with those four areas that I mentioned: personal representatives of estates, conservatorships, trusts, and powers of attorney. And it gives access to those fiduciaries so that they can do the job that they're required by law to do. You'll hear this morning some things. I just want to emphasize that we're not creating a new body of law here. This is intended to be incorporated into an already existing law governing fiduciaries and their responsibilities, the duties of loyalty and due care that they have in the job that they do. And we're asking that the law be amended to give those people access so that they can do the job that they are required to do for the benefit of beneficiaries of estate and for the protected person. That's the overview of the bill in a nutshell. I'd be happy to answer questions as we go, but I want to give time for the other witnesses here, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Victoria Blatchley. I'm a trust and estate litigator, so I deal with families fighting about wills and trusts and assets on a daily basis. I have 18 years' experience. I'm licensed in both Washington and Oregon. I'm also here as a member of the executive committee for the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Section. That organization supports Senate Bill 369 and opposes the related House bill. I'm also here as a commissioner for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. The commission supports Senate Bill 369 and opposes the related House bill. There's also a letter in support that's part of the records that you'll have before you as well to look over from the chair of that organization. UFADA updates state fiduciary law for the internet age. When a person dies or loses the capacity to manage his or her affairs, a fiduciary receives legal authority to manage or distribute the person's property as appropriate, as Lane said, under the well-established body of law of what fiduciaries can and cannot do. This legislation is moving forward in many states this year, and extending the authority to online information for fiduciary is a natural extension of the law. It used to be that when someone died, the nominated personal representative would bring the will to their attorney and say, "What do I do now?" And that attorney would provide advice that normally would include, you need to forward the mail to your address so that you can start looking through and finding out where the assets are and where the debts are so you can marshal the assets, pay the expenses of the administration, and proceed accordingly. But now, when everything is online, that's becoming more and more difficult, if not impossible. So this is what UFADA does, is assist those fiduciaries with doing their jobs under the laws of the state of Oregon. Every single day, fiduciaries deal with private information, and I want to reiterate what Mr. Shetterly said. There's already a well-established body of law in every state, including Oregon, that confirms when a fiduciary gets confidential information, they don't get to broadcast it to the world. They have this duty of confidentiality. UFADA does not change that. Most people now own a great variety of digital assets, including photographs, documents, accounts, websites, and more. But access to digital assets is often limited by custodians through restrictive terms of service agreements. I read recently that if you read all of the terms of service agreements that you sign up for in a year, that would take on average, I think it was like 70 days of your year to actually read through those documents. UFADA ensures that fiduciaries have the access they need to carry out their duties in accordance with the account holder's estate plan, if there is one, and otherwise in the account holder's best interests. It provides a predictable manner where a fiduciary, consistent with well-established fiduciary law, can deal with online accounts and assets. Otherwise, fiduciaries are the impossible position of being ordered to marshal and distribute assets without the ability to gain access. So, for example, people are seeking oftentimes to avoid the expense of probate by having their estate plan in a trust. So under current law, if you said you wanted everything put into a trust so that your trustee could have the authority to access online accounts, maybe make duplicate pictures of photos or delete certain accounts that you wanted deleted, under the current law, that would be difficult, if not impossible, to effectuate. So it's a very impossible situation to be in. So with UFADA, you choose what happens to your digital assets, what gets passed on to heirs in accordance with your instructions, and what gets deleted with you die. I will, in closing, just say that I've spoken on this topic in several different states to attorneys, to CPAs, to fiduciaries, to lay people, and the overwhelming consensus is citizens of America and Oregonians believe that if something happens to them, there will be somebody that can pick up the pieces of what they've left behind. And the law needs to catch up with that. So this is what the constituents want. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Who's next?
I am. Senator Prozonsky and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Jeffrey Sheen. I am an attorney in practice in estate planning and estate administration. I'm also the immediate past chair of the Executive Committee of the Estate Planning Section of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here on their behalf as well. Today I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 369. It is sponsored by the section. The reason that we brought this bill to the state of Oregon after the Uniform Law Commission crafted it was to try and level the playing field or spread out and create a smoother path for clients who are dealing with how to handle digital assets, either as part of their estate plan or they have become a personal representative or executor in an estate, and they're wondering on how to deal with the electronic accounts and assets that the decedent had. And so we've put forth that there's a competing bill that the tech industry has presented to you. We think our bill is certainly less intrusive to the court system, a better alternative. It also applies to providing fiduciaries with the same level of access to digital communications as they have with the physical documents of a decedent or protected person. This level of access allows fiduciaries, that is, executors, personal representatives, conservators, guardians, trustees, and agents under powers of attorney to obtain the digital information necessary to identify the assets, liabilities, and electronic communications of decedents and protected persons. Under current law, these digital assets can be lost if the providers refuse to allow fiduciaries access to these digital accounts. And under the competing bill, these digital assets will be lost if providers could refuse to allow fiduciaries access to these accounts, especially if the decedent has no will or has a will, but the will has no provisions authorizing the disclosure of digital assets. This whole area of dealing with electronic media has become a challenge for both any attorneys that are dealing with trying to assist clients with estate planning issues or estate administration, and it's also frustrating to the citizens of this state in that it's a gargantuan task just to sort out what their rights and duties are. So for that reason, we are recommend a due pass recommendation of the -1 amendments and request that you pass this bill out of committee. And for that, I will yield to Ben, who's the next speaker.
Good morning.
Good
Good morning. Chairman Przonski and members of the committee, my name is Ben Orzeski. I'm a legislative counsel with the Uniform Law Commission, and I work with all of the Uniform Trust and Estate Acts. Thank you for considering this bill. Senate Bill 369 is it's a bill to introduce this Uniform Act, UFATA, is how I'll be referring to it. And I just want to correct the record. Since Committee Counsel Newell had her statistics, there's been actually four more introductions. So UFATA has been introduced now in 26 state legislatures. And I also want to then talk about what's happened since it's been introduced. This is a brand new Uniform Act. So it's for us, kind of a big deal to get more than half the states to introduce a new act in its first year. A couple of large internet firms have strongly opposed this, and so they have managed to kill the bill in about six or seven of those 26 states where it's been introduced, and we sincerely hope that Oregon is not next for that. But I want to talk about the arguments that they have made against UFATA in those other states and explain why the committee doesn't feel those concerns are valid and how the committee dealt with those concerns. And they generally fall into three categories. The first is privacy concerns, and the second is a conflict with federal law, and the third is interference with private contracts. So I'm going to address each of those briefly, one at a time. Privacy, I want to be very clear on this. A yes vote on this bill would mean that Oregon citizens control their own digital assets after they die. They have the ability to say who gets access, or should anybody get access? Should it be deleted automatically after death? And a no vote means that the companies continue to control that, the disposition of those assets, probably through their terms of service, which are different from company to company, but are definitely within the control of the people who write those contracts, the terms of service. The most egregious example of the major firms is probably Yahoo, where their terms of service says that if you when they receive a death certificate, then they automatically delete everything. So if you've been receiving your bills or credit card statements or bank statements at your Yahoo email address, your executor won't be able to access any of that from Yahoo. The 100% of your digital assets can remain private, even from the executor of your estate, if you want to do that under this bill. The difference is that you control it, and you can do that the traditional way by executing a will or a trust, but the really kind of creative part of this bill that I think is going to be very useful is you can also do it with an online tool if the company provides that. So think of it as when you sign up for a retirement plan and you name a beneficiary for that account. It would be just as easy to name a beneficiary for your email account or for your Netflix account or whatever online account you want, but we're not asked to name that person when we register for an account. Probably the most progressive of the firms that has been looking at this so far is Google. If any of you have a Gmail account or a YouTube account, I encourage you to explore what they've done. They have a feature called the Inactive Account Manager, which is a very simple three-step tool. You choose a time period first. If the account has been inactive for a certain period of time, then they will try to contact you. And if not, then you tell them what you want to do with it. I want you to delete this account, or I want you to contact this person. I've got my wife named on mine. So this person at this email address and phone number, and give her access to the information. Let her download whatever she wants, whatever she needs. And then the third step is I can tell Google to either delete everything or to archive it. So that's the kind of tool that this law would enforce. And the key is that it's not part of the click-through terms of service. It's a separate choice that the user actually reads and has to it's a separate box to check, essentially. And if that's the case, if it's not buried in the general terms of service, then this law will enforce that. And a variation on the privacy concern is a third-party privacy. So the argument is there's a doctor or drug counselor who communicates with his patients by email. And then when that doctor dies, the executor of the doctor's estate has access to all of these personal communications. That's a red herring. If the doctor is communicating with those people by email, that doctor probably also has some paper documents on those same patients. And right now, under current law, there's a person who goes through those paper documents and contacts the patients and see if they want a copy of their record, and if not, destroy them. And that person is the executor of the doctor's estate. So it's not a stretch to say that the same person should also have access to email if we trust them to handle the paper files in a confidential manner. The second concern is a conflict with federal law. And the federal law that we're talking about is the Stored Communications Act. It's a criminal law, and it was enacted in 1986. And Congress was trying to extend the protections of the Wiretap Act. The Wiretap Act says that you cannot access a phone call. You can't tap a phone or a telegram without a warrant. They were trying to extend those protections to email and cellular conversations. And so that's what the act does. It says you need a warrant in order to access that information, and the company can't release it to anybody without a warrant unless one of several exceptions applies. So some of those exceptions are with the permission of the sender or the recipient of the communication or their agent. And the fiduciaries are agents under state law. The companies talk about being sued under this federal law, kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, where they could be sued under federal law for releasing information or sued under the uniform law, uniform state law, for not releasing the information. That also is not going to happen. This is a criminal law meant to prevent unauthorized access. It has nothing to do with fiduciaries. Congress has never legislated on fiduciaries, and nothing in the legislative history shows that they ever intended to work with fiduciaries. So just as there's no federal law that says the executor of your estate can close your bank account, withdraw funds, or sell your house, you know, if you were still alive, of course, that would be a crime. But once you die, that's what an executor does. That's their job. They have to settle the estate. It's the same way with access to electronic communications. What would be a crime while you were alive is absolutely permitted once you're gone for the purpose of administering your estate. So the companies will talk about lawsuits. They've never been sued for releasing information to a validly appointed state fiduciary. They've been sued for not releasing information, and they've been sued in discovery disputes or for releasing information to the wrong person, but there has never been a case where any of the major internet firms were sued for releasing information to a validly appointed state fiduciary, and that's all that UFATA would ask them to do. The third thing is the interference with a private contract. And, of course, the private contract that we're talking about is the click-through terms of service. Victoria has already mentioned it would take you over 70 work days of your year in order to read through what the average person agrees to in clicking through all of these contracts. UFATA defers to the terms of service in nearly every respect. Your executor does not gain any more rights than you had. And to use an example, if you have a Facebook account, Facebook does not lose any rights that they have in the property you've uploaded to their server when you die and your executor takes access of that account. All the contract does, it allows the executor to step into your shoes. They have whatever rights you had, no more, no less, and only for the purpose of administering your estate. So they can close it down, download the family photos if they want to. Anything you could do while you were alive, then the executor can do after you're gone. The only term of service that this law would overrule is a blanket prohibition on fiduciary access. If the terms of service say, as the Yahoo example I used earlier, where you cannot have access to this, we're going to delete everything, then that is overridden by this law as void against the strong public policy of Oregon, because we need to have the orderly transfer of estate assets. And that's where our estate assets are now, is often online. We don't have the family photo album anymore. We may not have documents in the file cabinet. We're probably using some sort of internet service to store those. So with that, I'll stop, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Questions. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple.
A couple.
Thank you. So in terms of having the same rights as the decedent would have, would the executor have the right then to post things on that page? So say, for instance, that it is a teenager that has died. Perhaps they have committed suicide because they are a transgender youth. Their parents have disagreed with their identity and their gender. The parent becomes the executor. Would this give them the right to go back and change the gender and the identity of that person following their own death?
Mr. Chair? No, Senator, it would not. And the reason is because it incorporates the full body of existing fiduciary law. So, for instance, if I die now, let me use an example of a tangible asset instead, and I have a country club membership, the executor of my estate can access that account in order to close it and to get a refund for whatever portion fees are refundable, but they can't go golfing. They can't use it for their personal benefit. And it's the same thing with an online account. The the access is only for the purpose of administering the estate, but that's not in this law. That's in the existing body of fiduciary law that Oregon already has.
Thank you. Another question?
Yes.
Thank you. So while I appreciate that it would take a long time to read through all of those terms of service that people read, I think most individuals believe that their information is private and that unless they've given their passwords to others, they won't be able to access it. I also think there are too many people that don't have wills where they would have made provision to protect their digital assets. How would those individuals be protected from an executor that may be a family member learning private information about them that they never wished to be disclosed? For instance, a child that they had placed for adoption years ago and their family did not know about that. Might they find that in an email account, an affair that they were having, email that they just sat there that in a paper asset would have been deleted or recycled or shredded, but it just sits in that trash folder in the email box? It just seems this is very different than tangible assets. When we put online the food we eat every day, the number of steps that we take, it's an extraordinary amount of personal information.
All right, we've got the question, and the answer is?
Well, the answer is the best way to keep information private is still to delete it. It's a little ironic that we have this situation. I think that when Google first came out with Gmail, they were the first to offer an unlimited amount of storage. They do that for their benefit, of course, because the data is valuable to them. But it makes the default that many of us, most of us, me included, just leave our emails on there and archive them automatically because that's the default. So, of course, the user, while live, can delete anything that they don't want seen. But using the online feature that Google has offered now, and I expect if this law passes, other firms will start to offer something similar, you can certainly have a private account where you say that, you know, I want you to delete this at my death. I think that by offering that, we're going to increase greatly the number of people who provide directions, because it's a lot easier to check the box and go through that. It takes about 2 or 3 minutes to go through the Google system than it is to visit with a lawyer and put out a full estate plan. But if you're asked the question, the same way we're asked when we sign up for a retirement account, then you can direct the email provider or whatever type of account you're opening what you want to happen to those assets. And so that's what it's in your control, whether or not you want that your executor to have access.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to include Bill Ashforth, Kimberly McCullough, Ann Blackwood, I believe, and then Megan Schrader, I believe. Oh, I'm sorry. Before we take that, I'm sorry. Senator Knope, you wanted to make some statements, so let the senator first speak, and then we'll bring up the other four. I apologize.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. Since I have a radio interview in about 3 minutes, this is going to be very short. As Senate Bill 369 is currently constructed, I have concerns, and those concerns really are around privacy. And I respect Lane Shetterly greatly. I believe he is the one who put my will together before a lot of this digital stuff actually got going. So apparently
he'll never tell us under the attorney-client privilege.
Yes.
You can either confirm nor deny.
Yes. I'm not going to get the same price I did back then for the update because we can't do that anymore. But I would just say that there are, I think, still lots of issues. I would encourage this this committee to look carefully at the privacy concerns, I think, that still exist about this bill. There are many, and I don't think those should be minimized. And I've come to this committee before to encourage you to affect privacy in other areas, and I think this is just one more area where I think we want to get it right. And so I would encourage you to take time, go through those privacy concerns, make sure that this is an Oregon kind of base bill as opposed to just a national uniform, because I think we want to do things differently here. And so that's just my encouragement. I think there's still work to be done as it relates to privacy, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to come and speak to you today.
Senator, I need you to put your name on the record, please.
Senator Knope, Senate District 27, which is Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. Thank you.
Thank you. And we just for everyone here, we're not moving this bill today. This is taking in testimony, and we have some modifications that are going to be considered that would be the Oregon way. All right. Thank you very much. So the four I just called up, if you would please come forward. Thank you. three, who are we missing? All right, who'd like to get started?
I'll start, Mr. Chairman.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Chair Prusansky and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Bill Ashworth. I'm Senior Legal Director of Public Policy at Yahoo. In addition to our corporate headquarters in California, Yahoo employs over 400 people in Hillsboro, Oregon, who support some of our most important products and services, including Yahoo Sports, mail, web hosting and development, advertising sales, as well as customer support, risk management, and online abuse teams. I appear before you today in opposition to SB 369. Specifically, SB 369 is based on a legal premise that contravenes federal law, thereby guaranteeing litigation for Oregon residents, and has serious privacy implications not only for the decedents, but for the living who were parties to the decedent's electronic communications. We believe there is a solution that will address the interest of all stakeholders, which is found in HB 2647. I also want to just say for the record, even though they're not here, my belief is that Google also is opposing this bill because they believe it overrides their inactivity account manager. Obviously, I'm not speaking on behalf of Google. That's just my understanding.
I understand.
Put that on the record.
Thank you for your pointing that out.
Thank you.
We'll have Google let us know where they
are. Right. So as an electronic communication service provider, Yahoo is subject to clearly defined rules under the Federal Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And ECPA imposes a broad general prohibition on the disclosure of the contents of an e-communication, such as an email, subject to very narrow exceptions, including, for purposes of this discussion, the, quote, lawful consent of the originator, addressee, or intended recipient. The consent exception says nothing about a fiduciary or an executor. In short, ECPA is a privacy statute, which says that the contents of everyone's electronic communications and online accounts will remain private unless one of the parties to the email gives permission for the contents to be disclosed. SB 369, on the other hand, is an access and disclosure bill, which says that when you die, the contents of all of your online accounts will be disclosed without your permission unless you take affirmative steps to keep those messages private. It does this by stating, quote, a fiduciary is deemed to have the lawful consent of the account holder, thereby attempting to impute or deem consent to disclosure of the decedent's digital assets by allowing the fiduciary to consent to disclosure on behalf of the decedent. 3 decades of precedent under ECPA declare that consent to disclosure of contents means the actual consent of the account holder. That is what the Department of Justice says in its Prosecuting Cybercrimes Manual, and that is what the California Court of Appeals said last October. In categorically rejecting the consent premise on which SB 369 is based, the court said the law cannot simply declare that users have consented when in fact they have not. Quote, ECPA is not satisfied by consent that is merely constructive, implied in law, or otherwise imputed to the user by a court. The California court reported never having found a holding to the contrary, and to the best of my knowledge, neither have the proponents of this bill, or else they would surely have cited it. But aside from the conflict with federal law and litigation risks, SB 369 makes the privacy risks even more severe by requiring the disclosure of content of a broader array of, quote, digital assets, including the content of emails, text messages, instant messages, blog postings, private chat room posting, voicemails, and social media accounts, again, most of which are content protected under ECPA. This new overbroad disclosure rule will very likely come as a surprise to consumers whose privacy expectations are likely to differ between traditional and digital assets. As a recent report of the Washington State Bar Cyber Law Committee noted in recommending that the Washington legislature reject adoption of UFEDA, quote, committee members made inquiries to colleagues, friends, and family members, and most were surprised and offended by the idea that their private accounts could be disclosed without their permission, and seemed to distinguish between accounts touching on personal, intimate, or private information, such as a chat room exposing a hidden disease or membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, that does not inherently need to be known by the fiduciary, and non-personal but confidential accounts, such as bank and stock accounts, that inherently do need to be known by the fiduciary. There is a way to address everyone's interests and solve for the overwhelming majority of cases where it is necessary to administer the estate of a decedent. ECPA, while prohibiting the disclosure of contents, allows email service providers to disclose records or subscriber information, such as the to and from lines of an email. So, fiduciary could be provided with the outside of the envelope information, alerting them that the decedent had received emails from Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Vanguard, Fidelity, whoever have you, and thereby allowing the fiduciary to contact those entities and inventory the decedent's financial assets. Importantly, this could be done without compromising the privacy interests of the decedent or living third parties, or subjecting email service providers to liability under federal law for disclosing the contents. This compromise, again, is found in HB 267. So it would be interesting to ask the proponents, why isn't that enough? Why is it necessary to see the contents of every single email, text, IM, or blog posting that the decedent ever composed or received in his or her lifetime? Unfortunately, SB 369 takes no such nuanced or considered approach. It forces the old rule of fiduciaries stand in the shoes of the decedent into new technologies which operate under different rules and different consumer expectations. It creates confusion and certain litigation at a time in people's lives when they are least prepared for such litigation, while trampling the personal, intimate, and private details of the lives of the living. It's drafted with one stakeholder's interest in mind. Like Washington, New Mexico, Colorado, Georgia, Montana, Maryland, Virginia, Wyoming, and North Dakota, this committee should reject that approach and work towards a solution that addresses everyone's interests. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take questions.
All right. We'll take the questions at the end. Kim?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough, and I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. As you know, the ACLU is particularly concerned with individual privacy rights, and for that reason, we're very concerned about Senate Bill 369. We do appreciate and understand what the proponents are trying to get at, but what we believe is that this bill goes too far. It provides too much information when much, much less would be sufficient to actually administer an estate. The point that we really think is very, very key here is that while Senate Bill 369 would allow some control by a user, the default is disclosure. And we think the default should be privacy. Rather than forcing people to take affirmative steps to protect their privacy, they should take affirmative steps to share their information. That said, obviously there's some information that fiduciaries just need access to, whether or not somebody took affirmative steps or not, and providing metadata or that envelope data, the names of the financial accounts that they emailed with and so on, that information would accomplish this goal without compromising people's privacy. I'd like to give a few examples of the type of information that could be contained in these emails or these social media accounts that could get communicated. For example, a person could be LGBT, never have come out to their family. They could have communicated that to their friends and not communicated it, never expected it to come out, only to have that deeply personal thing about themselves revealed after they die. Now, that person may also have a partner, right? Their partner may also be in the closet. And that person now has been outed to the fiduciary. Now, I want to address one thing, which is that fiduciaries do have duties, and that is true. But when you're deceased, you can't advocate for yourself anymore. And so the idea that the deceased is going to somehow going to be able to then protect their privacy from the grave is a bit dubious. So I have concerns that, granted, fiduciaries have duties, but fiduciaries in this context are often family members, a parent, a sibling. And although those people may have duties, there is still a lot of danger here that, you know, families talk, they communicate information, and again, that person is not really able to advocate for themselves. In addition, the third party whose information may be then spread through the family and friend network, the damage is already done once that happens. And we certainly have heard of some horror stories of types of things like this happening, and particularly regarding LGBT folks who have passed away. So fundamentally, we believe that the user should be able to have autonomy to control. We don't support terms of service agreements that just automatically do one thing or the other. The ACLU does think that the user should have control. And so we think it would be best if this was something where you could decide it in your estate plan under user controls, and then again, the default being privacy with just this envelope data that is revealed. I'd also like to bring up something which, you know, we keep talking about digital assets, and certainly this involves intellectual property, which is a type of asset. But intellectual property and your physical property are really very distinct. And digital property and physical property, again, are also very distinct. The digital world and the intellectual property world really, it contains all of the stuff that has to do with our identities. So it's not just, you know, my letters and my belongings, but it's essentially the inside of my mind. I mean, at this point, everything is online. And particularly as young people are coming up, growing up, everything in their lives is online. And so I think that it's really important that we think about these things just differently. I also wanted to talk about one thing, which was the red herring of doctors talking to their patients. I think that's actually a little bit of a misconception of what our perspective is. A person could be talking to their doctor, but they could also be talking to their friends about personal health information or their addiction information. And so that's the type of information that could be revealed here. Let's see here. I also wanted to just point out that sometimes people online have information that they don't share with anyone. For example, there's a service called LiveJournal where people can get online, and I have an account myself, and the settings are so that I'm the only person who can see that. Also, people have like Flickr accounts on their Flickr account where they have their photos. They can also set that, and I also have many, many photos that are set to just me. And so when people have those types of accounts, this idea that they could just delete them if they don't want anyone to have access is a little inconsistent with how they actually work. People have information online that they don't expect anyone to see ever. It's absolutely personal. They don't share it with anyone. The idea that they should delete that just doesn't really work with the way that that works in real life. The other point we wanted to bring up is that protected persons are involved in this. And protected persons who are subject to a conservatorship may need help with their financial situation or with managing their life. But those individuals also have privacy rights, too. And they may have personal communications that have nothing to do with managing their life, that they should still have a right to have private communications with someone. And in fact, those private communications, I think, are actually also essential for that person to be able to be safe, because they may need to have private communications with someone who's not their fiduciary or their conservator. So I think including that and having this huge access is particularly troublesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Anne Blackwood on behalf of Facebook in opposition to the bill. At Facebook, when a person passes away, we do our best to respect that person's wishes. And we don't think that a person should have to have a will in place for that to be the case. When a person dies, we memorialize their account. And when we memorialize the account, their privacy settings remain intact. So if they posted information, pictures, what have you, comments on their Facebook profile, that information will stay with the audience they selected. So if they only wanted a narrow audience of 5 people, but not their coworkers or not the parents to see what they've posted, then they can do that, and that remains the case. When we memorialize account, we also, what happens is the word remembering goes in front of the person's name, so it makes it clear that the person is no longer living, and their biographical information reverts to past tense. So in my case, it would say Anne Blackwood worked at Facebook. Additionally, now we've launched a tool called Legacy Contact. And what that does is it allows a person to designate a trusted friend. In my case, I've designated my best friend, and she'll be able to manage my account in a limited fashion after I pass away. In that setting, you can also designate if you want that other person to be able to download all of your content. So in our case, the default is privacy unless the person chooses that they want the other person to have complete access to their information. And even in that case, we're not allowing the tool to give the other person access to all of the person's Facebook messages, because those were never really intended to go to a broader audience. Those are, you know, nowadays messaging is more like a phone conversation or a chat, and usually between 2 people. Finally, the tool allows someone to choose to have all of their information deleted after they die. And again, even though we're giving someone that affirmative choice, in essence, right now, what we have in place is a middle ground. We allow someone, whatever they've said they want to have happen with their account information, if we don't have any better information than that, then we allow those settings to stay in place. If they want to say they want everything deleted, we allow for that as well. And if they want to say, I have this trusted friend and I want that person to have complete access, we also allow that. We're very concerned that under SB 369, the default completely changes to complete access. And while we understand that fiduciaries have certain responsibilities under the law of confidentiality, when you're talking about someone who's a next of kin who maybe wasn't expecting the person to pass away, and the person before they died wasn't thinking about what was going to happen with their Facebook account, we're very concerned that allowing that person complete default access to everything is not in line with what the person expected, not in line with the person's privacy wishes. So with that, I'll ask for your no vote against this bill. I understand you're not going to take a vote today, but
that's correct.
Appreciate your time.
Questions? I've got two.
Yep.
Probably Bill or for Ann. Under the term of service agreement, my understanding now that the majority of the service providers just have it within their agreement that you basically click through as to what is going to happen. We've heard that Google actually is now have an affirmative process step that actually puts it up there and requires the user to actually go through and deliberately say what they want to do. What's the problem with having that? So for you, Bill, with Yahoo, why wouldn't Yahoo do that?
Yeah, so, and just to be clear.
The question was, why wouldn't Yahoo do it?
Sure. We may in the future, and I think the reason that a sort of initial sort of click-through choice would not be appropriate as a per se rule for all type of online services is that all online services are different, and I'll give you an example.
Okay. I appreciate that they're different. So let me go to the next question. What's to stop the state from actually requiring that for service providers in this state?
I've just give you the same answer, because it might not be appropriate for all different online services. You could basically mandate, I suppose, that all services do this, but think about like an online dating service. Think about if, you know, everybody, there should be some services where the default rule should be without a doubt, under all circumstances, privacy. If I sign up for an online dating service and I assume that the communications with the person on the online dating service are going to be private, but the person I'm communicating with has said, disclose all my communications, that's going to take me by surprise. I'm effectively going to be at the mercy of that other person's disclosure rule when I'm expecting
that my communications
are going to be private.
Thank you very much. I understand your advocacy for your client.
Sure.
To me, the question was, what could this state do? I'm trying to get beyond where we're at. We seem to have the same problem year after year, and we're trying to find solutions. This is Senator Knope said, we're looking for ways that Oregon can take care of. And from my perspective, if you have an affirmative reason for the chair or for the user to actually have to go through that step, they can protect their side. There's no way that you're going to be able to protect whoever you send it to. That's your own risk of who you send stuff to. So the last question I have for you is the to from under this under the House bill is apparently okay with the service providers. Subject line equals contents. Is that a position that people are taking? So I'm trying to figure out why we don't have subject line included.
Right.
Because that seems to me giving the individual who's trying to be the personal representative or the executor of the estate the opportunity to know who or what that issue was that was discussed in that email.
Right. So subject line can convey meaning. And so I think that's the difference. I know, you know, I'm a very busy person, and sometimes I'll put in, if it's a short message that I need to convey, I'll put what I have to say in the subject line. So, we can think of all kinds of different permutations of what might or might not go in a subject line, but that's the bottom line. And the federal government has, in the federal law, a subject line is not included, and so we're just doing what would be consistent with federal law in that thinking.
Let me follow up one other question. I understand if you have a to-from that actually has a commercial entity such as Bank of America, what if a person actually has taken out a loan from a private individual? There's not going to be any way of knowing that that individual that's on that to or from line is actually has some type of financial agreement with the deceased. So I'm trying to figure out how does the fiduciary understand and know who they should be dealing with when they don't have access at least to the subject line.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, yes, I mean, Chair Brzezinski, there are absolutely cases that need to be addressed. There are tough cases where we need to sort of figure out what the rules are going to be for those difficult cases. I think, you know, our ask in the interim or our recommendation in the interim would be, let's go after the low-hanging fruit. Let's take, the House bill, which sets out rules for disclosure of records. Again, like I said in my testimony, puts the fiduciaries on notice as to who the financial or the banks or the stock, you know, the brokerage firms that the fiduciary was communicating with. They pick up the phone. They inventory the account. They inventory the assets. That should probably get them, in addition to all the tax forms that they use as part of the, you know, winding down the estate, that should probably get them pretty far as to where they need to be. We can do that easily. The legislature can address that low-hanging fruit easily. We can iterate to that test case. We can then talk about the tougher test cases and think about how to address those.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. Megan?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Megan Schrader. I'm the executive director of TechNet in the Northwest region. TechNet represents over 70 of the nation's leading companies in the fields of information technology, e-commerce, internet media, and venture finance. As you've heard today, the technology industry has some serious concerns with Senate Bill 369. And although TechNet holds the utmost respect for the ULC as a longstanding institution that's created many good policies over its years, we believe they got it wrong with UFADA. When the ULC met initially, it was to address a blind spot for estate attorneys. And as the working group progressed, the technology industry explained obligations and liabilities under federal law, ECPA, as well as our members' terms of service commitments to its users. We believe that the ULC overreached in three ways in the Uniform Act. The first, the scope of who gets access after a person's death or incapacitation is far too broad. The bill gives all fiduciaries access to a person's digital life and communications, not just estate attorneys. For those who have died, their next of kin closing the estate would have unfettered access to the contents of their private communications. For people who are still living, the bill gives their power of attorney full access to their private thoughts. And just a note here, close to half of American adults don't have a will or other estate plan in place. Among minorities, that number's higher. 68% of black adults and 74% of Hispanic adults don't have a will. UFADA privileges privacy to those only with the means to have a legal document in place before death. Second, the Uniform Bill allows access to all contents of all electronic communications. You've heard many examples, voice messages, instant messages, online dating messages, text messages, etc., regardless of whether the deceased has given consent. You've heard lots of good examples today about the exposure to third parties in communication with the deceased and could have massively unintended consequences for the living third party. Next, the bill considers fiduciaries as able to deem consent, even though federal law is very clear that consent can only come from the sender, addressee, or intended recipient. Our members will have to choose, be in a very awkward situation, whether to conform with federal law or state law if the bill passes. Finally, the bill disregards the express privacy choices made by users in their user settings during their lifetime. User privacy settings are the key in determining what an individual may want done with their online accounts, and they expect those choices that they made in life to continue after death. NetChoice commissioned an independent poll of 1,000 registered voters nationally at the end of January, and they found that 70% of people said that nobody should have access to the content of their private messages and photos unless they gave prior consent. That's a nearly 5-to-1 margin over the 15% who said that an estate executor could control and decide what to disclose. That means 70% of people might take issue with UFADA. As you've heard from others, UFADA has been defeated this year in states all around the country. The industry has supported a better way forward that solves for the blind spot and complies with federal law and terms of service agreements. The PEACE Act that was passed in Virginia last month and is moving in Oregon as House Bill 2647 respects user choices, it keeps privacy as the default, and it allows estate attorneys to address the blind spot by providing the records of communication if a will or user setting is silent. So I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions? Thank you, Megan. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 369. And now we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 390. All right, Laura's going to be giving that. So while we're changing counsel here, John Van Lanningham and Deborah MC. And while we're getting settled, is there anyone else who's going to want to testify on 390 besides the two that are at the dais? All right. So, Laura, when you get it settled, why don't you go ahead and give us an overview?
Absolutely. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 390 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on the Judiciary. We don't have the paperwork back for this today. There is an underlying bill, but we're looking at today as a proposed Dash 1 amendment that completely replaces that bill. That amendment is the result of work done by the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition. That coalition, my understanding has met 11 times between September 2014 and February 2015. For 3 hours each time to negotiate the proposed Dash 1 amendments to this bill.
John?
I just want to say for the record, groups like this can make our job relatively easy. I appreciate what you do.
Absolutely. John?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Lanningham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County and have for about 37 years. Not all of that time I've been involved with the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition. That coalition started in the early 1980s. At that time, it existed consisted of two people, Emily Cedarleaf on behalf of landlords and Michael Marcus on behalf of tenants. We are now much larger. My email list is in the 60s. And as your staff noted, we met 11 times for this particular bill. We've had a consensus bill, every session since the early 1980s except one in 1999 when we agreed to take a break and work on affordable housing funding. Sometimes we have some strong disagreements. This time we worked hard and we don't have any disagreements. The members of the coalition, several of whom are in the room, include Multifamily Northwest. Deborah Imsey is going to speak in a second. Oregon Rental Housing Association, Rental Housing Alliance Oregon. Those are the three large landlord groups in the state. Community Alliance of Tenants, a Portland tenant advocacy group, Oregon Law Center, Legal Aid Services of Oregon, my own organization, Lane County Legal Aid, the Oregon Housing Authorities, and the City of Corvallis, and then two groups that I failed to name in my written summary on OLIS, Portland State University's Tenant Advocacy Program. Well, a lawyer from that group worked with us, and Northwest Real Estate Investors Association, who is here in the room, another landlord group. The printed bill, actually, Elsie made a mistake. The printed bill should be carried over into the amendments, and so we need to work on the amendments to get them right. We just got them last night at 9:30. My written summary describes what should be in the final bill, and in the sake of interest of time, and given that only us landlord-tenant nerds really care about the details, I won't go into those details, but could answer questions.
All right, thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Imsey, and I'm the executive director for Multifamily Northwest. Multifamily Northwest represents property managers and owners of more than 150,000 units across Oregon and Southwest Washington, from owners of thousands of units to mom-and-pop operations with one or two rental houses. These properties also range from market rate to very affordable. Each year, we provide hundreds of classes and trainings on a wide array of issues. We provide rental forms that set the standard for the industry. All this information and experience informs our work with the Landlord-Tenant Coalition. Our organization has participated in the coalition for nearly 25 years, and we know the value of coming together in advance of the session to discuss housing issues and reach an agreement on important housing policy. The coalition has been vetted by Bill has been vetted by a wide range of stakeholders and represents a balance of housing interests and concerns. As with any coalition agreement, we had to compromise, and so did others. But as John summarized, the end result is truly a bill that landlords and tenants support, with meaningful improvements to housing policy. Coalition members come to housing issues with a wide variety of perspectives. It's one of its great strengths. We work through the practical application of each policy, ensure it aligns with existing state and federal housing law, and assess any unintended consequences. Once we commit to a coalition bill, we also commit not to end run the effort by supporting or opposing other legislation affecting Chapter 90. The coalition is a great resource for legislators with an interest in housing policy, and I encourage reaching out to us as you develop legislative ideas. Multifamily Northwest supports Senate Bill 390 with the finalized amendments. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you all very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 390. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 405. And Laura?
Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 405 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon Law Commission. We don't have the paperwork back on this today. So this one, I believe, actually does replace the entire contents of the bill. So what we're looking at today is the Dash 2 amendment. That amendment makes minor changes to ORS 419A.255 to correct unintended consequences that were the result of some recent changes. That section of the Oregon Revised Statutes addresses maintenance, including disclosure, providing transcripts, and exceptions to confidentiality. So the Dash 2 amendments provide Oregon Youth Authority the authority to disclose the same information about youth within their jurisdiction as the juvenile courts and county juvenile department can disclose. And it also clarifies that nothing in current law prohibits a juvenile court from providing certain information to the appropriate child support program administrator. The proposed Dash 2 amendment also proposes a one-year extension to the operative date of statutory provisions regarding providing access to juvenile court records to other persons not specifically provided access by statutes.
All right, thank you. Phil Schradl and Christine Kirk. While they're getting settled, was there anyone else who wanted to testify today on 405? Bill, were you going to start off?
Chair Przanski, yes, I will. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Interim Deputy Director Philip Schradl for the Oregon Law Commission. This bill does come to you from the Oregon Law Commission. It's the result of a review of the statutes dealing with juvenile records after the advent of e-court. There were a number of changes made in the last couple of legislative sessions with respect to juvenile records. And experience has shown that a couple of minor modifications need to be made. The Oregon Youth Authority received advice from the Department of Justice that the current provisions seemingly prevented them from disclosing information about youth that are in their authority. And that causes difficulties because they can't even respond to subpoena requests that might be submitted respecting information about the youth that are in their jurisdiction. And it hampers their ability to provide services to the youth who are within their jurisdiction. The other minor modification has to do with the fact that the juvenile courts themselves understood that the statutory modifications prohibited them from providing information about termination of judgments terminating parental rights or judgments terminating wardships, and the outfall of that prohibition was that they couldn't convey that information to the appropriate child support program administrator, which led to child support obligations being enforced past the appropriate date. We brought this back to the Oregon Law Commission because there was concern about another provision that was in those modifications, which had an operative date of September 30 of 2015, and that has to do with the juvenile court's ability to provide access to any other person authorized by the court. At the time that provision was enacted before, it had a delayed operative date, and that was due to the fact that there was at that time pending litigation that called for all of the judiciary members of the work group to be recused from being able to participate in discussions to develop appropriate policies and guidelines about how to implement that provision. That litigation only concluded in December of 2014, and that caused us to reconvene the work group. We had a work group meeting, and there was a proposal from the Judicial Department about how to implement that provision. But the discussion, it was a rather robust discussion in the work group, and even so, there weren't all the members of the work group who were able to attend. That led to the conclusion that we need additional time to try and work out those policies and guidelines about how those provisions can be implemented around the state consistently. So we asked that the operative date of those provisions be extended for one additional year so that the work group can reconvene in its full body, have robust discussions about that, and come back for the 2016 session with proposal about how to implement those provisions. With that, I'll allow Christine Kirk, who's here from the Oregon Youth Authority, to add any additional comments, but I'm certainly happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
All right, Christine.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Christine Kirk, and I'm the Government Relations and Public Policy Manager for the Oregon Youth Authority. I just want to note that the Oregon Youth Authority is in support of 405, the amendment, excuse me. While this is a really simple change, it will have a profound impact. Anytime that there is law that is understandable and logical, it is easier for us to consistently apply that in the organization. When that comes to releasing non-confidential information, it is really important to have clear and consistent law, and so we're very supportive of this. I would be remiss if I didn't note the appreciation for the Oregon Law Commission for the work that they do in providing a forum to talk about juvenile court records. As you know, there are many parties that are interested in juvenile court records, and simply having a place where we were able to bring this issue and talk about it amongst many different viewpoints to reach a conclusion on what was best for the juvenile court records is of great value, and I just wanted to recognize that appreciation for the Oregon Law Commission. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 405. Now we're going to open up our last hearing for today, Senate Bill 913. And Laura, if you give us the overview.
Of course. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 913 is sponsored by the Committee on Judiciary. The bill is not ready to move today. So this bill, African elephants and other animals such as rhinoceros have long been hunted for their ivory tusks and teeth or horns, directly leading to significant declines of populations. So despite decades of international and domestic intervention, populations continue to dwindle. So in early 2014, the Interior Department's Fish and Wildlife Service announced a virtual ban with a few exceptions on the trade of ivory within the U.S. And the United States does remain the second largest market for ivory in the world, they report. So current Oregon law does not regulate this type of animal parts trafficking. So Senate Bill 913 creates the unclassified misdemeanor offense of trafficking animal parts, including ivory, ivory product, rhinoceros horn, or rhinoceros horn product. The bill defines relevant terms, outlines prohibited conduct and exceptions, and it lists punishments for first, second, and subsequent offenses. Additionally, Senate Bill 913 directs the courts and the State Department of Fish and Wildlife on forfeiture, transfer, and destruction of ivory. The bill applies to purchases, sales, offerings, possession, and imports occurring 180 or more days after its effective date.
All right, thank you. All right, so first of all, as counsel said, we're not moving the bill today. We're only taking testimony. I want everyone to understand that. Second of all, I have five new people that have signed up since we started the hearings this morning, so we're going to be in a time management scenario. What I'm going to do is I'm going to have a panel of four. Senator Haas is here. Would you bring your chair up when you come up so we can have four chairs up? So with the senator, we're going to also have Natasha Dolezal. Thank you. Iris Ho and Danielle Gabriel. I believe those four, if y'all will please come forward, will be our first set of panels. While they're coming up, there are two people that signed up at the after we got started that did not say if they're for or against. Rebecca Roth, are you wants to testify? Could you, Rebecca, please? All right. And regarding, is it Kathleen
Cremonese?
Yeah, for or against?
For.
Thank you. Senator?
Senator Przanski and committee, thank you for holding this hearing on this very important bill. My name is Mark Haas, state senator from Beaverton in Washington County.
Senator, could you move the mic just so we make sure he's getting caught? Thank you.
He's new. So.
This is a very intimidating panel, I must say. Really, experience and brains and a little bit of something else there. When an elephant is hunted for its tusks, poachers rely on machine guns, machetes, and poison darts. Elephants and rhinos die a cruel and often a very agonizing, painful death. In 2014, poachers killed 30,000 elephants in Africa. There are about 500,000 elephants left on that continent, down from 5 million in the 1930s and 40s. The ivory is shipped all over the world, mostly to Asia, but a lot of it ends up in the U.S. This bill, Senate Bill 19913, would ban the sale of ivory in Oregon, a state with a very strong conservation spirit and a love for wildlife. It includes exemptions for antiques and educational collections. There are already federal regulations designed to stop the sale of ivory. So why do we need a state law? Well, you'll hear various reasons, and you'll hear a lot of reasons, but essentially, federal laws on ivory trade are confusing and ineffective. They treat different kinds of ivory differently. Only experts can tell the difference between different species, and this leads to consumer confusion and misrepresentation on the part of ivory traders. Federal bans on ivory are also very difficult to enforce because they're limited to interstate and international commerce. And this means law enforcement's hands are tied when it comes to trafficking within state borders. But with this change, they would have a clear directive to investigate interstate sales, and it would also give judges much more discretion in fining, sending a strong message to poachers and traders. Another reason, I think, for a state law is really to continue to raise awareness that poaching of these great beasts continues every single day and is increasing. Here in Oregon, we have a long tradition of advancing animal welfare. Oregonians have supported our efforts to ban the practice of horse tripping, and it recently outlawed ownership of exotic pets. Now it's time to extend the conservation spirit to the majestic creatures of Africa and Asia. Humans can live without ivory. Elephants cannot. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the senator? Mark, thank you very much. Ladies, before we take your testimony, I didn't put down one of the other ground rules. If you have written testimony, please, if you haven't already submitted, please submit it. And please do not read your written testimony into the record because it will be part of the record. What we need you to do is please summarize the points that you want to make so we can get sure, make certain we get everyone have the opportunity to testify today. So who would like to start off?
Sure, I'll go first. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Iris Ho. I'm the Wildlife Program Manager at Humane Society International. HSI and our U.S. affiliate, the Humane Society of the United States, and strongly support Senate Bill 913. Senator Haas briefly mentioned various exemptions that this bill will amendments that this bill will offer, and I think you know this bill is a very crucial and sensible legislative tool that will ensure that Oregon does not become a safe haven for illegal rhino horns and ivory trades. The bill would give limited exemptions to legitimate antique firearms and also musical instruments, because we believe that these items have not proven to be a source of illicit ivory. However, you know, it would essentially shut down the market for ivory here and rhino horns in Oregon. And the reasons why we need this essential tool is because, you know, federal law governing the ivory trade is confusing and riddled with loopholes. For instance, we have, you know, trade of Asian elephant ivory that's governed by Endangered Species Act, while, you know, African trade of African elephant ivory is governed by the African Elephant Conservation Act. And, you know, these trades, you have different cut of years and different type of documentations requirement. For example, if it's Asian elephant ivory, then, you know, antique of Asian elephant ivory could be traded, you know, for interstate commerce. And then if it's African elephant ivory, then it has to be imported, you know, prior to 1990, or it has to be imported with the pre-CITES convention certificate. I mean, it's just too confusing. You have, you know, various cut of years, and nobody, you know, knows. Sometimes, you know, even enforcement agencies, and let alone consumers, they don't know what type of regulations, federal regulation there are. And that's why state has the authority and prerogative to implement and institute a stronger law. And precisely because of this reason, the state of New York and New Jersey last year have enacted strong laws prohibiting essentially all trade in elephant ivory and rhino horns in their states. And the laws passed overwhelmingly in these two state legislatures and signed into law by Governor Christie and Cuomo. And, you know, that's why, you know, we're hoping that, you know, this bill, Senate Bill 913, will do a similar. And in addition to, you know, the confusing federal law, there's also a lack of insufficient enforcement challenge on the federal level. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service established its enforcement branch 30 years ago. And 30 years after, we still have the same number, similar number of enforcement agents across the U.S. ports. And it's impossible with the limited resource they have that they will be able to stop these illicit ivory. You know, once they enter our border, there's almost no way for our enforcement agents, given their limited resources, to go after these dealers that are selling illicit ivory. And so, you know, so these are the, you know, the reasons why the Senate Bill 913 will greatly complement the loopholes and insufficient enforcement challenge that we're facing on the federal law. And states are, you know, a great partner on many issues in combating illegal wildlife trade. And so I, you know, urge your strong support for this important legislation, and I'll be happy to answer any questions afterwards.
All right, thank you. Who's next? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Danielle Grabiel. I am a senior wildlife policy analyst with the Environmental Investigation Agency, or EIA. EIA is an international campaigning organization dedicated to investigating and exposing environmental crime around the world. We have been working to stop wildlife trafficking for 25 years, and we've completed more investigations into the illegal ivory trade than any other organization. Before I begin my testimony, I would like to make a brief personal statement. I am an Oregon resident. I live on a small farm at the base of Mount Hood with my husband and young children. My husband is a professional fishing guide and a recreational hunter. We own guns. And I would really like to put to bed the idea that all Oregon gun owners are against this legislation or view it as a threat to their right to bear arms. I certainly don't. I can see this bill for what it is and for what it clearly is not. This is not a gun control bill. It is an anti-extinction bill. I think, and I really sincerely hope, that we can all agree that poaching is a bad thing, that extinction is tragic, and that we Oregonians have a duty to do all that is within our power to prevent it. So, putting my policy hat back on, I'll tell you a little bit more about why laws that ban ivory and rhino trade work and why you should support this bill. Bans work because they send an unequivocal message to consumers. Bans work because they eliminate cover for illegal laundering operations, and bans work because history proves that they do. At the dawn of the 20th century, it's estimated that 1.3 million elephants roamed the African savanna, but by the late 1980s, nearly half of these creatures were wiped out to supply the then-legal international ivory trade. In response to this, the first global elephant poaching crisis, the first ever ivory import ban was implemented by us, by the United States. The U.S. ban on ivory imports was crucial in cutting off a major ivory market. It prompted similar policies around the world, and eventually an international ban was agreed in 1989. As a result of the ban, which worked, the world's major ivory markets were shut down, the price of and trade in ivory dropped, the illegal killing of elephants declined, and many elephant populations began to stabilize and rebound. The international ban on commercial elephant ivory worked because it sent a simple, clear, and very public message to the ivory consumers of the world that buying ivory leads to the slaughter of elephants and that it would no longer be tolerated. It worked because it made enforcement straightforward. Trading across ivory borders was illegal, period. The markets responded, demand plummeted, and domestic trade collapsed. So you probably want to know why we are facing another global elephant poaching crisis and rhino poaching crisis. That's because the international ivory trade has been undermined. When the countries of the world agreed in 1999 and in 2008 to allow so-called one-off exceptions to the ban to permit the sale of ivory to Japan and China, a dying industry was sadly resuscitated. Customers, particularly increasingly wealthy, middle-class Chinese consumers, once again believed it was okay to buy ivory, and buy they did. Proponents of the one-off sale theorized that they could meet the demand in China and Japan, flood the domestic markets, and reduce ivory prices as well as the demand for ivory goods. Instead, the sales helped to stimulate the market demand, confused consumers, and provided an avenue to launder illicit ivory from Africa through poorly regulated legal domestic ivory markets. Poorly controlled legal domestic markets, ineffectual enforcement, and corruption remain the primary drivers of the sharp rise in elephant and rhino poaching in Africa today. But don't think that the problem is limited to China and Japan. Indeed, the U.S. remains one of the top destinations for illegal ivory and rhino horn. And that is why national and state-level bans are absolutely essential to our global work to save elephants and rhinos. Despite the best efforts of enforcement officers, most wildlife contraband still crosses international borders undetected. Without strict national and state-level measures to control and limit domestic trade, illegal wildlife products are easily laundered onto the domestic market and passed off as legal to unsuspecting consumers. Domestic trade bans, such as that proposed by the Obama administration, and state-level bans, such as the proposal in SB 913, pull the rug out under the smugglers and illegal traders by removing their cover. My friends, we are again facing an elephant and rhino poaching crisis. More than 30,000 elephants were slaughtered last year to supply the global ivory trade and to line the pockets of organized criminals and terrorists. There is a very real possibility that the African elephant will be extinct before my six-year-old daughter graduates from high school. I am not being dramatic when I say that that time is running out for Africa's elephants and their rhinos. We, as Oregonians, have an exciting and unique opportunity today to do our part to make sure extinction doesn't happen on our watch. Please join me. Please join me in supporting Senate Bill 913. Thank you.
All right, Natasha.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Natasha Dolezal. I'm a resident of Southwest Portland, a constituent of Senator Burdick, and I'm here today as an animal law attorney in support of Senate Bill 913. I want to thank Senator Haas for his leadership and support on this bill. Based on what my colleagues have said, I will try to summarize my testimony and offer the unique perspective that I bring. What is Oregon's role in this crisis? I've been fortunate enough to travel back to Kenya over three times in the last year and a half as part of the Kenya Legal Project, which is based at the Center for Animal Law Studies at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland. We are working with Kenyan prosecutors and judges, conservation groups, law schools, and we are going there and we are trying to say, what can we do in the U.S.? What can we do in Oregon to assist your efforts on the ground? They are struggling. They are trying to stop the bleeding there. I'm happy to report that in 2013, they amended their Wildlife Conservation and Management Act and finally passed stiffer penalties for poachers, whereas before, poachers would come into court, pay a fine, plead guilty, and be back in the park the next day. They've changed their laws. Now poachers face life imprisonment. And when I've asked them, what can we do in the U.S., how can we help, their message is clear. This is a global crisis. One or two countries alone are not going to be able to stop this. They've asked every jurisdiction around the world to implement a complete ban on the selling of ivory and rhino horns if we want to stop the bleeding and save these animals. Kenyans recognize that their economy, their stabilization depends on wildlife. They have a ban since the 1970s against sport hunting. They are there to conserve their resource. But today, the elephants and rhinos are still being slaughtered. We haven't talked much about rhinos. They're in dire conditions right now. One every 8 hours is killed. There are only 4 surviving northern white rhinos in the world. 3 of them are in Kenya. 2 are in zoos. We are watching extinction happen. These animals will be extinct. The 3 that survive in Kenya will not be able to reproduce. But there is hope. And in Kenya, I saw a commitment to this crisis, and they still need our help. And the world is watching. They are watching. I will return there in May and June with other lawyers from Oregon, with other law students from Oregon who are committed to this work. And I will be pleased if I can go back and say we are helping. Oregon is helping. Oregon cares about the wildlife of the world and the stability of the planet and the economic prosperity of that region. And in closing, I'd like to offer another statement from a colleague and a friend I have in Zimbabwe who is pleading for us to come there and to help what's going on in Zimbabwe. Under Mugabe, he is there literally alone, protecting over 740,000 acres of a conservancy. He trains park rangers, and he tracks rhino 24 hours a day, but they are still losing their rhino. And he wanted me to pass on a message to you that as rangers, it doesn't make sense for us to put our lives on the line every day to protect the same wildlife that people legally are trading in body parts. The laws need to reflect the intrinsic value of these creatures, or our risk and work seems futile. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much. Our next panel is going to include Craig Campbell, Laura Dunn, Grant Spickle Meyer, I believe, and David Crackle or Cracky. And same request, if you have written testimony, please don't read it in the record. And if you can summarize, that would be appreciated.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. We had originally raised some concerns about the acquisition of musical instruments for our musicians in the state of Oregon. The -1 amendments address those concerns. The one thing we would ask is on the record, on the floor, if it could be clarified that a musical instrument includes those items that are critical for the playing of the instrument, such as with a violin, the bow. So if that can be taken care of, that takes care of our concerns, and we support the bill. And I'll stop with that.
As you know, we're not moving the bill today, so work with council to make certain that if we move the bill forward, it will be an amendment. Next.
Mr. Chair and the committee, my name is Grant Spiegelmeyer. I'm the curator of education at the Oregon Zoo. As you may know, the zoo is a service of Metro, the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area. I want to thank you for the opportunity to offer this testimony on behalf of Metro and the zoo in support of Senate Bill 913. Oregon and the Oregon Zoo have a special connection with elephants for more than half a century, from the birth of Packy in 1962 to the discovery of elephant infrasonic communication in the 1980s to the opening of the zoo's new Elephant Lands exhibit later this year. The Oregon Zoo has also been supporting conservation across elephant range countries for decades, and in 2013, we joined the Wildlife Conservation Society's 96 elephant campaigns to help bring an end to the trade that kills elephants for their tusks. You've heard a lot of testimony about what's going on with elephants. I just want to offer one personal story. My dad lived and worked in Tanzania for 2 years in the 1960s as part of the Peace Corps. And when he came home, he brought several ivory items with him back as mementos of that trip. When he made those purchases, elephants were relatively plentiful, and he knew that money that he spent on ivory artifacts was going back into the local communities that were harvesting elephants for food. Things have changed really dramatically in Africa since that time. Well-financed and heavily armed poaching rings target an ever-dwindling population of elephants. Elephants are killed primarily so their tusks can be turned into ornamental objects that are quickly shipped overseas. This provides huge profits for international crime and terrorism and very little for local communities. Al-Shabaab is one of the organizations that we know profits from this activity. China is often blamed for driving the poaching of elephants, but the United States is a major contributor. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service states that it's extremely difficult to differentiate legally acquired ivory, like the items my dad brought home in the 1960s, from ivory derived from poaching today. Criminal investigations and anti-smuggling efforts have clearly shown that the legal ivory trade can serve as a cover for illegal trade. A 2014 study in California showed that roughly 50% of the ivory being sold there was illegal under federal law. So for those reasons, the Oregon Zoo, our goal is to create a better future for wildlife, and this legislation gives Oregon an effective tool for protecting these iconic animals. I know that if my dad was still alive today, he'd be happy to forego any profit he could get from his sale of legal ivory artifacts so that his grandkids and eventual great-grandkids could have the chance of living in a world where Africa continues to be home to thriving herds of wild elephants. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Laura Dunn. I'm an attorney with the Animal Legal Defense Fund. We are a national nonprofit. We are dedicated to protecting the lives of animals through the legal system. I work out of Portland. We have an office there. I'm with the Criminal Justice Program. I'll be brief. I know that we're short on time. I will point you to our written testimony, which you should have before you, and just say that for all the reasons that my colleagues have stated, ALDF is very much in support of SB 913 with the amendments, because, in short, no trinket is worth the life of a critically threatened species, and I would take any questions you might have. Thanks.
Thank you. And David?
Thank you, Senator Przanski, members of the committee. My name is David Cracky. I'm an attorney. I'm also a member of the international board of an organization called Wild Aid. We are an international conservation organization whose motto is, when the buying stops, the killing can too. There's near unanimous support for strong elephant and rhino protection. It's not a bipartisan issue. It's almost a nonpartisan issue at this point, which we are truly appreciative of. Wild Aid strongly supports this bill. We have had some success in China and in Vietnam and other Asian countries through our education programs that reach approximately 1 billion people per week, and we are seeing some really positive direction going in those societies with regard to these items. I'm always concerned also about precedent, and in 2011, this legislature passed the ban on shark fin possession, trade, sale within the state of Oregon. We joined Hawaii and Washington shortly after Oregon passed that ban. California did as well. And after California did, Beijing apparently noticed and they banned all shark fin soup from official state functions. It was an incredible milestone for the protection of those endangered species and other shark populations. Since that time, since 2011, shark fin consumption in China is down between 50% and 70%. And that is important, and I think that the analogy works for this bill as well. There is, as we've heard, an environmental crisis occurring with rhinos and elephants. This is one of the ways that we can be part of that puzzle that seeks to protect those animals across the globe. I hope that this will, first of all, that this bill passes and the message will be heard in China and in Vietnam and in those other areas. Finally, there really isn't additional time for this. There is no ability to kick the can down the road for elephants and rhinos, as that road is essentially a dead end for them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel is going to include Kevin Sterik, Dan Reed, Alvin Richards, Doug Ritter. Morning, gentlemen. Who's going to lead?
I'll start. For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. I can assure you that I very much want to save elephants, almost an endangered species in this building. But the problem is I don't really see how this bill gets us there. We're going to not going to stop the trade in ivory by making things that people already own have no value. And also, this bill includes mammoths, and as some of us know, those are extinct and are still extinct, and not from poaching by terrorists. But there's a bunch of other just technical issues with the bill that really I'm curious about. For example, we're going to have an exception if the ivory on, say, a gun or a knife is less than 20% of the volume of the item. I don't really know how you measure the volume of a revolver. I haven't been able to figure that one out. And as has been pointed out, it's very, very difficult to determine the age of ivory. And so if we have a mandate that we have a certain age ivory, how is that going to be enforced? I mean, are we going to carbon date the stuff? On top of that, the bill calls for fines based on the fair market value of the ivory. And if we render it valueless, where do we get a fair market value for the ivory? And finally, there's a mention of not only rhino horn, but something represented as rhino horn, which seems to me to be fake rhino horn. So are we going to make it a crime to be in possession of artificial ivory horn? So it is in no way, no interest in shooting elephants. I just don't want to see the value of things that people already own destroyed, because I believe that's theft, and I don't really think that saves a single elephant.
Thank you. Dan, are you next?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Dan Reed with National Rifle Association. The NRA applauds serious efforts to stop poaching in the illegal ivory trade. However, SB 913 would not accomplish that goal. Instead, it would target those who've illegally acquired ivory, such as sportsmen, hunters, recreational shooters, who have gone out, maybe inherited this or purchased this in good faith. And this would essentially render those items valueless. I heard earlier the U.S. Fish and Wildlife was mentioned, and historically they maintained the position that most ivory in the U.S. has been legally imported and did not materially contribute to the illegal ivory trade. Nevertheless, SB 913 goes after the sale, purchase, and import of these items. Kevin talked about the Dash 1 amendments, and I echo some of those sentiments as far as being able to determine value or volume of ivory for an item such as a revolver. Also, there's a requirement regarding documentation, and a lot of these items, documentation wasn't required when they were first or wasn't required when they were acquired. It kind of runs together there. But what's sufficient to establish documentation of something that's 100 years old? Also, looking at that 20% example, let's say you had two people who bought an item at the same gun store on the same day, and one of them acquired a shotgun that has an ivory bead, and the other one has a revolver that has ivory grips with ivory inlays, and maybe it gets over that 20%. One of those now can legally sell that. It still maintains its value, whereas the other one, he's out of luck. So the NRA stands in opposition to the illegal ivory trade and poaching. But this will not save an elephant. This is little more than a symbolic measure, and I ask you oppose this bill.
Thank you. Who's next?
I guess that would be me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Doug Ritter, and I'm here representing Knife Rights. Knife Rights has also submitted detailed written testimony opposing SB 913, and I will just summarize.
Thank you.
Knife Rights represents America's and Oregon's millions of knife owners and collectors, knife makers, scrimshaw artists, knife retailers, and suppliers to knife makers and scrimshaw artists, many of whom own legally acquired ivory or knives with ivory components. And as it turns out, like many Americans, our members also own a wide range of ivory items, from musical instruments, pianos, guitars, to firearms, objects de art, and et cetera. Knife rights and all that we represent abhor the poaching of all animals and elephants and unequivocally support science-based conservation efforts that have proven successful in posting significant gains in elephant populations in Africa. We also applaud and support law enforcement efforts in Africa that have posted significant reductions in poaching in Africa over the last 3 years. SB 913 will not save a single living elephant, and it will have a severe negative financial impact on many of your law-abiding citizens who own or work with ivory. Does not reduce poaching. 913 does not reduce the market for illegal ivory. 913 is an emotionally driven, feel-good, do-bad legislation. 913 flies in the face of study after study and federal government statements that have noted that there is virtually no market in illegal ivory in the U.S., and that the legal trade in decades-old legal ivory in the U.S. has no influence whatsoever on poaching of elephants in Africa. We have heard from a number of people that the United States is the second largest, has the second largest trade in ivory in the world, and I do not dispute that. The difference between us and the largest trade in African ivory, which is China, is theirs is illegal and ours is in decades-old legal ivory that's been owned by Americans for years. The concept of an illegal ivory market in the U.S. flies in the face of common sense. The black market price of raw ivory in China currently exceeds $1,500 a pound. The price for perfectly legal decades-old ivory readily obtainable from a number of suppliers in the United States is approximately $250 a pound. Why would criminals risk severe penalties that America provides for ivory smuggling when they can get five times that in China, which has lax customs control? We support the efforts to control poaching in Africa. We are conservationists. This misguided ivory ban bill is ill-conceived, offensive, and an unconstitutional taking of millions of dollars of private property from American citizens. Knife Rights urges you to vote against SB 913, a bill that would unfairly penalize Oregon's ivory owners for others' illegal and immoral activities that continue to threaten elephants and which this proposed ivory ban does nothing to ameliorate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Alvin?
Yes, my name is Alvin Richards, Senator Przanski and panel. I am a knife maker. I'm a resident of Salem. Excuse me.
You want to put that up on the counter? Yep, certainly.
These are samples of ancient ivories that I utilize in my craft. I have three different varieties. We have mammoth, walrus, and actually mammoth tooth. These ivories are pretty distinguishable between elephant ivory and the ancient ivories. Most of them have been mineralized heavily, and even the ones that have not been mineralized have a telltale sign on the ends that are called Schrager lines. And the angle at which these Schrager lines intersect can determine whether the animal was extinct or extant, or elephant or mammoth. Mammoths have been extinct for over 10,000 years. There's no bringing them back unless we have a Jurassic Park issue. Most of these are colored in different colors. They come in blues, reds, greens, browns, yellows. Some of them are not. There's one piece in here that looks very much like fresh ivory. However, it is an extinct piece of mammoth ivory. This represents a significant investment for me. This is a small portion of what I own currently. If you pass this bill as written, I will not be able to utilize this. There are many of my fellow knife makers and craftspersons that have also made these investments. I am against poaching of any animal, against illegal poaching of the African elephant. I do believe that there are ways to utilize the materials that we have and readily available to us that have been extinct for years and still be able to protect the elephant. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher.
Real quick, Dan, you said something to the effect that most of the ivory was imported legally into the United States and did not materially contribute to the illegal ivory trade. Where did you find that information?
That's from, Mr. Chairman, through you to Senator Thatcher. That's from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and I'd be happy to send you the article.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife, okay. Because it just went counter to what I was just hearing in previous testimony about us. Yeah, anyway, it just seemed. Thank you. I just wondered.
So, Alvin, I noticed that you reside here in Salem.
Yes.
Would you be willing to give us contact information? Because if there's going to be a work group looking at how this could be modified and stuff, I'd like to have your expertise brought to that table.
Absolutely.
If you'll be willing to give that to us, that way we know if we're going to move forward with other amendments, because I'd like your perspective.
Other questions or comments?
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, our last panel includes Rebecca Roth, Kathleen, help me out with that, some ceremonies?
Cremonese.
Okay, come on up. And then George Tulek. That's the three I have for the last panel. So if you have written testimony, please don't read it. And if you can summarize, that will get us out on time. Thank you.
I guess I'll go first. I spent my young years in a small town called Jokapunda.
If you can give us your name first.
Oh, Rebecca Roth.
Thank you.
And from Salem, Oregon. Now, but I was from Jokapunda. My grandparents and my parents also lived in Congo. And ivory was widely available. And one of the things that's trying to be done with the banning of ivory is to stop the use of elephant products at the far end. But I believe that the better way to address this whole thing is to address the tribal people who are in the area. For one thing, they don't have a strong sense of property. My dad always kept chickens, trying to get people to understand farming, and he would hire young boys to watch his chickens, and when they became of age, he would give them chickens to start a chicken farm of their own. Well, invariably, the tribe showed up to eat the chickens that night. So there's not a strong sense of property among the tribal people. The things that are available belong to everybody, and so the missionaries who worked with the people there were trying to develop a sense of property and a sense of farming. One of the things we're dealing with is that the people of that area were not at a farming level of society. They were hunters. I often watched a whole group of people come past our home carrying elephant parts for market. They have had a farming society. Not a farming, a hunting society. And now that the elephants are off limits, they're no longer able to create the artifacts. I have a whole house full of artifacts that's been given to us or we've purchased in the market legally from the people who lived in that area. They lived on the elephant trail. They lived with the elephants. And when elephants are killed by wild animals, when a baby elephant is killed by a wild animal, that baby elephant is never going to produce the ivory that an elephant produces. So that's a whole other area. But these people, when they're denied the resources of their of what's there, and they don't have a strong property viewpoint, they're easily led into people who have money who come and who want to give them money to poach. In other words, what I just heard them say is they're going to start putting all these people in prison for the rest of their lives because they've been denied being able to develop the resources that are available, that are off limits. And the way better way, I think, is to develop a sense of farming in these people. We're not talking about India, where the people have a strong sense of ownership of their elephants. In India, there's not a problem in India because people are guarding their elephants, their prized possessions. They're elephants. They love them, and they farm them. And in Africa, they need a stronger sense of that the elephants belong to them, and the products of the elephants are able to be marketed on the international community in a legal fashion. We need to not make their lives and their resources illegal. Here in Oregon, we've just created marijuana being legal because we've not been able to stop the cartels. And here we're talking about cartels over there that they're not going to be able to stop them because the cartels are always going to be able to use every bit of money that's available and technology to elude the law enforcement officers. So let's work with the community to develop the people to guard and prize their elephants.
Okay, thank you very much. Who'd like to go next?
Okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My apologies, I do need to read this. This is my first time testifying in any capacity. It's very short.
Start.
I have no official affiliation with any of the groups that are here. My name is Kathleen Cremonesi. I am a constituent from Elmira, Senate District 4, and I am here to urge you to support SB 913. I, too, own a gun and a collection of knives. Although I do not hunt, generations of my family have and still do. Some are past and present members of the NRA. I have had a deep connection to elephants for nearly 30 years, beginning in my 20s when I joined an Italian circus by chance while traveling through Europe. While there, I fell in love with the elephant caretaker, my future husband, and I had the honor of working and living in close proximity to elephants for almost 3 years. A circus is a horrible place to keep elephants, and I do not condone any animals being kept in those conditions. Although I have never personally witnessed physical abuse towards those specific elephants I worked with, I feel very strongly that keeping an 8,000-pound animal chained to a 6-by-10-foot wooden slab for over 23 hours a day is in itself serious abuse. I feel even more strongly about the ivory trade and how it is decimating the elephant population. One elephant is slaughtered every 15 minutes for its tusks, 96 a day, 33,000 per year. If this continues, elephants will be extinct in the wild in 10 years. Ivory trafficking is the fourth largest illegal trade in the world, and it supports terrorist organizations such as Al-Shabaab, which earns $600,000 per month from ivory sales. Al-Shabaab is the terrorist organization who assaulted Kenya's Westgate Mall. It doesn't stop there. Al-Qaeda, the Lord's Resistance Military, Janjaweed Militia, Boko Haram. These names strike fear in our minds, and they all use money from illegal poaching to finance horrific attacks.
Even terrorists will abide by the rules of supply and demand. If fewer people buy ivory, fewer elephants will be butchered. Illegal ivory flows into first world markets camouflaged as legal ivory. It is our duty as citizens of Oregon and citizens of the world to make every effort possible to stop black market ivory trading in our state. Oregon is a small drop in a very large bucket, but we've been on the forefront of many important causes in the past. What happens now with the ivory trade will affect Oregonians and the world for generations to come. Elephants around the world are under attack from deforestation, tourism, circuses, and the ivory-related slaughter. They are evolved, intelligent, majestic, beautiful, sentient beings, one of only eight species, including us, who are known to have the self-awareness to recognize their own image in a mirror. Ringling's decision to phase elephants out of their circus performances is a huge stride forward, and it could help make 2015 a great year for elephants, but we need to keep that momentum going if we are truly going to make a difference. Please do not hesitate to take action on ivory now. Help make 2015 the year of the elephant and recommend a due pass to your colleagues on SB 913. Thank you for your consideration.
Kathleen, thank you. And I did catch the article that was in the Register Guard, I believe, last week. I saw your face, and I just knew there's resemblance there. George?
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George Okulich, on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society. As I am the last person to testify, and it's 10 o'clock, I will be very brief. I have submitted testimony from Sharon Harmon, our executive director, and sort of out of the testimony, the two things I just wanted to highlight for the committee are back in 2013, this committee and this legislature passed Senate Bill 6, which made a very bold proclamation that animals are capable of experiencing pain, stress, and fear, and should be cared for in ways that minimize pain, stress, fear, and suffering. And we believe that this statement wasn't followed by any sort of specific species or that it didn't apply to animals outside of Oregon. So we wanted to put that on the record. And then secondly, just last month, the United States Department of the Interior, Justice, and State acknowledged the threat posed by wildlife trafficking to both conservation and national security and released an implementation plan for the National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking. In the testimony I provided by Sharon Harmon is the actual site to that study. But basically, that did plan really made the link between sort of organized crime and wildlife trafficking, and basically showed that, you know, this sort of ivory trade is linked to other black market crimes like drugs, human trafficking, firearms, etc. And I'll stop right there and hope that you'll encourage your passage of Senate Bill 913.
Thank you. Questions? I want to thank everyone who's been here for this last hearing on Senate Bill 913 and all of the perspective you've given to the committee, and also the timeliness that you worked under so we could finish 1 minute after. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I just want to say that even with the Dash 1 amendment, if I was to, for example, sell my grandmother's ivory inlaid cutlery, I would be a criminal. So we need to take a hard look at some of those.
As I said, we will be working on this. So with that, we're we're out of time.
Okay.
So at this point, we're going to go ahead and close the Senate Bill 913 public hearing, and we're adjourned for the day. Colleagues, remember, we're on 8 o'clock starts.
For how long?
Remember, we're on 8 o'clock starts.